You are listening to Off the Page on WRKC Wilkes-Barre, a series featuring students reading the works they've created in and out of class.
My name is Noreen O'Connor, and I teach in the English department at King's College. I teach in professional writing, and I'm an assistant professor of English. Actually, a lot of the pieces were written for a class. It was called Creative Nonfiction. And in that class, the students were exploring different kinds of nonfiction writing, talking about how narrative structure can be used to tell a story, but a nonfiction story. A lot of the pieces that people were writing, I kept thinking that they would be great if they could develop enough of their own writerly voice to be able to read them out loud. And the particular students, they have been performing their pieces or have been developing really personal kinds of voices. I think that their work is really good to be performed, to be heard. And you can do that with nonfiction. You don't just have to do that with fiction. Probably the thing to remember about writing is that it's a long process. It's a process of working through ideas. It's a process of really being careful with language. It's a process of editing and re-editing and taking your work to class and workshopping it and talking with other people and then coming back around and playing with it and working on it until you get it really polished. And I've seen these students do that. So I think the thing that makes these pieces good is how much work they put into it to get it to that place where they're really ready to go out and be heard by a lot more people.
My name is Jen Kazerski, and I am a senior graduating May 2011 with a degree in English literature and secondary education. The first thing I remember writing actually is a silly little poem in first grade. I could recite it for you if you'd like. It's short. It is night. The stars shine bright. Two owls take flight in the deep, dark night. That is my first and last foray into the world of poetry. From there, I decided clearly creative writing was not for me. I went more into writing for expression, writing to tell personal stories in a lot of cases. I like memoir writing, and I really enjoy essay writing, like literary essays. My piece is called Skinny Pictures. In Jennifer Weiner's Good in Bed, the plus-size narrator, while waiting in the office of a dietitian with several other overweight women, observes, "Regular women carry pictures of their babies, their husbands, their summer houses. Fat ladies carry pictures of themselves at their skinniest. 3 years ago, while reading the novel on the plane ride home from Florida, I promised myself that I would never have skinny pictures, that I would never go back to being fat. After spending years as the fat friend and the ugly sister, I had finally reached my dream. I was thinner than my sister ever could be, and the skinniest of all of my friends. Some girls aren't meant to be a size 8, my mother had told me in the car one day while I was obsessing to her about how much I wanted to lose another 10 pounds. You've lost a considerable amount of weight in the past 8 months already. You should be proud of yourself, but remember, you don't need to lose any more. Some girls aren't meant to be a size 8. That sounded like a challenge if I had ever heard one. Some girls would be content with losing 70 pounds in 8 months. Some girls would be happy dropping from a size 22 to a size 10. I was not one of those girls. When I was 16, my mom took my sister Missy and me back to school shopping at the outlet mall in Tannersville. After several unsuccessful searches for clothes that would fit me and not look like something my grandmother would wear, I was ready to give up and go home, but Missy still wanted to look in Arapa's stall. While Missy added several adorable polo shirts, denim skirts, jackets, and a pair of pants to her pile, I stood aside, trying not to make eye contact with any of the sickeningly sweet size 4s working the registers and the floor. "Jenny," Missy called from the fitting rooms. "Jenny!" I slunk over, trying to remain invisible. "What?" "You know those pants in the window? The green ones?" "Yeah, what about them?" "Can you see if they have them in a size 3? The 5s are too big." "Sure." I tried not to feel bitter. "Think small," I thought to myself, maneuvering around the closely spaced racks of the clothes. "Just get the pants and get out of here. Maybe no one will notice you." "Can I help you?" I had been intercepted. "Maybe." I turned to the skinny little salesperson, plastering what I hoped was a smile on my face. "I need the green pants in the window and a size 3, please." "Oh, honey, I don't think that you need a size 3. Her smile became more of a cruel smirk. "Why don't you try looking across the street? I don't think we carry your size here." Slinking away, mortified, I returned to the dressing room empty-handed. Missy opened the dressing room door a little bit and thrust her hand out. "Did you get the pants?" "Get your own damn pants," I snarled before storming out of the store. my heart pounding painfully in my chest and my eyes burning with unshed tears. The pain and embarrassment of that incident haunted me day and night. I was just too big to be allowed. My size, which had previously made me uncomfortable in social situations, now made interactions with other people unbearable. I became obsessed with what people saw when they looked at me. Did they see Jen? Did they just see a fat girl? Was I more than that? I avoided mirrors and cameras. I declined party invitations and school functions. I retreated into myself even further. Something had to change. I hated myself, and I hated my body. I needed to take control of it, to show it who was boss. I needed to win. And so I set a reasonable goal and set off on my first serious diet in November of 2005. By the following Christmas, December of 2006, my diet consisted of carrot sticks, fat-free cheese cubes, the occasional piece of grilled, flavorless chicken breast, and once a week either half of a small slice of pizza or a taco from Taco Bell. I only drank water, black coffee, and Diet Coke, and my friends were beginning to get mad at me. "You're seriously ridiculous," Jess had snapped at me during lunch one day, watching me count out my cheese cubes. "Eat a sandwich, a pizza, anything. I'll friggin' buy you a steak." Megan tried a different approach. "Jen, this is an intervention. You know we love you, but you really need to start eating." "I'm fine." I usually shrugged off their concerns, and sometimes snatched a few potato chips from one of them to prove my point. "I just get sick if I eat too much before practice," or, "My mom's making a big dinner tonight, and I want to save room." I would push extra hard at swim practice those days, trying to sweat away the grease from the chips. Another 1,000 yards, just another couple 1,000 yards. It hurt, and I would be exhausted, but by Christmas, I was almost a size 6. By April of 2007, I was only eating carrot sticks. Prom was coming up, and I needed to make sure I could fit in my pretty princess dress. I wanted to feel like Cinderella. Rags to riches. To have a fat girl to goddess transformation. I could fit into a size 4 and was smaller than my sister, who now fit into a snug 10. It was a wonderful feeling to make her ask the clerk for the smaller size for me for once, to be the pretty sister, the skinny sister. It was wonderful to be the one that people noticed first when we went out. I loved my new body. My new body, though, didn't love me. My fingertips had begun to turn orange, and my face had a jaundiced tinge. My fingernails would peel and break, and my hair was dull and starting to fall out. My cheeks were sinking in, and the skin under my eyes was dark. I couldn't really sleep anymore, and everything made me cry. "Your mother's really worried about you," my father said one weekend while we were working around the house. "You really need to show her that you're eating. If you don't, we'll have to send you away." I shrugged it off. "I'm okay. I'm almost to my goal. Then I'll stop. I promise." "What is your goal?" he asked me. What was my goal? I pondered this and cried. My goal was 30 pounds and 5 sizes ago. My goal was Gap and American Eagle. I was so close. But so close to what exactly? Every time I'd reach a goal, I'd think, one more size, another 10 pounds. Leave the fat girl behind and become beautiful. Become sexy and hot and everything you dream that you be when you were fat. Become your dream self. Well, where was my dream self? My freshman year of college was rough. I had put back on 5 pounds before the first day, much to my dismay but my mother's delight, and had moved away from carrots and added fruit and the occasional Frosty to the mix. I had started using the counseling center on campus and putting back on the pounds. With help, I learned to become okay with it. After a while, I didn't even notice the weight gain. It was not always easy. I had many downs where I'd be tempted to crash diet, but I rediscovered the things I had loved the most. Cake, French fries, hamburgers, ice cream, pierogies. I was learning to love food and myself again. In February of 2010, 4 years after I started my dangerous dieting and 25 months since I had begun the healing process, I flipped through my senior year 2007 album on my MySpace page and really looked at my skinny pictures. There I was, 17 and 18 years old, the skinniest girl in my family and of all of my friends, but also the most miserable. Skinnier does not equal prettier, as the too thin arms, jutting collarbones, innumerable ribs, and twig-like waist of the girl in the pictures indicates. The sallow, haunted girl with a bald patch forming along her hairline was not beautiful, but most importantly, she was not happy. I have taken control again. It's time to put away those skinny pictures, to close that chapter of my life, and move on. My weight doesn't control me anymore. My worth is not measured by the numbers on a scale or on a clothing tag.
You are listening to Off the Page on WRKC. This series highlights students reading their original stories and poems.
My name is Ruth Roosey. I'm a retired teacher. I'm 91 years old, and this is how I live United. I say retired, but not really. Once a week, I read books to children as part of United Way's education program. Reading to a child creates links between language and literacy. It creates a bond between grown-up and child. And believe it or not, it prepares them for a better academic future. Oh, we read about frogs and flies and pigs with wings, all sorts of juicy stuff. It's a joy to watch all those little faces. I figure I have the time and they have the need. And I've always believed that if we're not here to help each other, then what are we here for, really? My name is Ruth Roosey. I help kids prepare to succeed in school. So I don't just wear the shirt, I live it.
Give, advocate, volunteer, live United. Go to liveunited.org, brought to you by United Way and the Ad Council.
From the vantage point, Mafatu saw six war canoes drawn up on the beach. But what held the boy's eyes in awful trance were the figures, the eaters of men, cannibals. Mafatu watched the strange scene, powerless to move. In that very instant, he heard a crashing in the undergrowth. Four figures were tearing through the jungle. He turned and ran blindly down the trail, thinking only of his canoe. If only he could reach it before the savages overtook him. Explore new worlds. Find out what happens next by reading the book Call It Courage by Armstrong Sperry. For other great book ideas, visit literacy.gov. A message from the Library of Congress and the Ad Council.
Hey, this is Kate Pearson from the B-52s for Rad. Getting drunk is your own business, but when you drive drunk, you make it everybody's business. Don't drink and drive. Be responsible, plan ahead, and choose a designated driver. Remember, music lives, and so should you.
A public service message brought to you by the U.S. Department of Transportation, RAD, the National Association of Broadcasters, and the Ad Council.
We now return to Off the Page on WRKC Wilkes-Barre, Radio King's College.
Hi, my name is Kevin Conroy, and I'm from Mrs. Jennifer Yankowski's creative writing class, and I'll be reading a few works today. The first is a poem named Drive. Red sunlight and nothing but blacktop and concrete guardrails. Will I make it? Will I arrive in time to? Oh, but how couldn't I? White dashes dividing lanes blur. Now one, separate no more. Identity lost on the side of the road. The setting sun rests on my dashboard. Radio on, no Johnny Cash. I grip the side mirror, parting my fingers in the cool summer air. Slicing it like a paper cut. Blood dripping along my hand, covering my wrist. Almost there. Don't go. Oh, you can't go. Trees and power lines open before the road. Split like the lips of my beloved, whispering goodbye. This poem is called Primrose Hill. Broken weather stands outside the door as I pace back and forth through the kitchen. The grass ripples on the other side of the little window. An electric breeze born in the womb of a storm cloud parts its fingers through the slender blades. I look at the clock hung crooked by the fridge, its little hand ticking mercilessly. They will be here soon. There's nothing I can do. They will not listen to reason, I know. They didn't with Sylvia. She tried, I know she tried, but today her house stands empty. Stripped sterile, almost as neatly as her bones, bleached whiter now than the grounds of a salt flat at midday. I won't go peacefully. The 44 weighs heavily in my hands. My knife sags at my side, diligent. I pace. The bowl of fruit on the table shrieks at me, spewing reflected lightning beams from the storm. The clock ticks.
My name's Allison Morgatron. I'm from Mobile, Alabama. I originally wanted to be a veterinarian when I was growing up, and that was very important to me until I got into college and I started actually doing schoolwork. And I realized that my classes, my favorite classes were my English classes. So I was in class, in my organic chemistry class, and I realized that I really wanted to be in my English class. And so I took a few years off to make sure this was the right decision. I came back to King's and I was an English literature major. The piece is about my husband, Ralph, and his passion for guns and for shooting. It was the first thing that really attracted me to him. And in this piece, I go to the range with him, and I really think that I got to know him on a deeper level because I now like guns too. And my piece is called My Day at the Range. My husband, Ralph, shoots. He's what I call a gun guy. Before we met, I knew nothing about guns. But now, I know more than I ever thought I would. I can tell a bolt from a barrel and a stock from a safety. This is because guns are Ralph's passion. Asking Ralph about guns is a great conversation starter. It always has been. When you ask Ralph about guns, he just opens up. When we first met at a high school reunion, he talked to me about guns. I found it intriguing and sexy. Guns actually had brought us together several years after our first meeting. We had not followed up on our initial attraction at the reunion, and we were excited to chase the spark 2 years ago while on Facebook. After several days of instant messaging, I told him to call me because I wanted to ask him about what kind of gun I should get. He was shy, and I knew this would get the conversation rolling. I was right. We talked every night after that for 2 months. 2 years, we were married. When he took me with him to the firing range, or as he says, the range, for the first time, I had the opportunity to not only learn more about him, but also about the culture of gun enthusiasts. The range is located about 45 minutes away from Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, and situated in the mountains near Ricketts Glen State Park. On the drive there, I began interviewing him for this paper, and his startlingly blue eyes behind his glasses widened with excitement over the prospect of talking about his passion. The first gun I got was a Remington 600 and 6mm Remington. I was about 13 or so. The first gun I owned was an Armalite AR-180B, and I was 19, he said with pride. I've always been interested in the military. Guns go hand in hand with that. Also, my father owned some. From those small seeds, a tree grew. A tree did indeed grow. Ralph currently owns 7 guns, 3 pistols, and 4 rifles. He can describe each one in minute detail, and he knows all of them closely. Each of them does different things. The M4 is a pretty classic American rifle that I own because everyone does, and it's quite good. The AUG I own because being a bullpup, it's short and more compact than the M4. I own several pistols because they're different sizes, and thus some are easier to carry than others. The smaller ones sacrifice some things, though, like magazine capacity, barrel length, and sight radius. Barrel length affects bullet velocity and sight radius. The distance between front and rear sights affects accuracy. Personally, my favorite gun in his collection is the Walther PPKS because it is petite, silver, and actually fits in my small hands. If you could call a gun cute, this would be the one. Ralph has the Virginia concealed carry permit, which enables him to carry a gun in a holster where no one can see it. I carried anywhere the law allows because 1, I can, 2, unarmed people are victims waiting to happen, and 3, because it annoys a large part of the population. And as for problems with carrying, other than some stupid and annoying laws, I never had a problem. Ralph carries whenever he can. He can't carry it all in D.C., where he works, and he can't carry in restaurants when he plans to have a beer or two. Otherwise, whenever we are out, if I hug him, I can feel the gun in his hip holster. Ralph will only live in states that recognize gun rights. Currently, he lives in Virginia, because there are a few restrictions on where and when he can carry. Because Ralph works as a contractor for the Navy in Washington, D.C., he has several choices of states to live in: D.C., Maryland, or Virginia. He is from Pennsylvania, which also recognizes gun rights. He has really done his research on gun laws and can list the gun laws and political attitudes of every state. PA state law allows you to carry everywhere except federal buildings and courthouses. And courthouses must provide a place to check your firearm. PA state law authorizes carry in schools, although federal law does not. As for Virginia, the state excludes some places like churches, unless you have a reason, bars, but that has been repealed, and a couple other places. He would never live in Maryland or D.C. because D.C. allows no carry at all, even though they have an insane crime rate. And although Maryland has permits, they're impossible to get. My Virginia permit isn't recognized there because Maryland is run by anti-gun Democrats who are utterly out of step with the vast majority of the country that allows the carry of firearms. It's easier to get a permit in some parts of California than it is in Maryland. And California is run by idiots. We recently took a trip to San Diego and fell in love with the city, with its green hills and sandy beaches, gorgeous climate, and charming old town. I even found myself dreaming of what it would be like to move there. I didn't let myself dream for long, because first I had to find out whether it was even possible, i.e., what the gun laws were like. Ralph's answer: we'd only consider moving here if they changed the gun laws. California doesn't give out many carry permits, and most of the guns I own are illegal there. There is a concealed carry movement, though, so maybe in the distant future. My heart sank a little. Moving to San Diego sure was a pretty idea. But you know, in the end, gun rights are important to me, too. Because Ralph is a conscientious gun owner. He belongs to the National Rifle Association, or NRA, which fights for gun rights. Current NRA issues that affect Ralph, he tells me, are mostly the right to carry guns, and to a lesser extent, the existence of the National Firearms Act of 1934 and all its amendments. The NRA also advocates gun education, and Ralph agrees. Children should be introduced to guns slowly and carefully as they mature, and with an iron fist backing it up. Ralph is also very safety conscious, and prior to my day at the range, He went through an extensive safety briefing with me. He also took me to a local sporting goods store and bought me safety glasses and ear protection. Or ears, as he calls them. In his Saturn Ion on the way to the range, I asked Ralph about how his passion is perceived by others. When people learn of my passion for shooting, most of their reactions are positive, one or two are negative, and a bunch of neutral. I asked him if, as a gun owner, he ever felt stereotyped. All the time, he answered. According to a number of people, some in the media, if you own a gun, you're a racist redneck with no education, who is totally paranoid. Although he is occasionally stereotyped, Ralph's enthusiasm for guns breeds friendships with other gun owners. There is a connection that the love of shooting brings out. Guns bring people together. Ralph tells me, AR15.com and many other gun sites has people from various backgrounds and races. Ralph talks to others on the internet, in particular AR15.com, which according to him, has a bunch of forums from general discussion, which is full of nonsense, to various technical forums discussing everything from optics to ammo. His buddies and he go to the range often. There's a lot of male bonding going on. But shooting is not just for men. A lot of women are interested in it too. Now, after shooting, I have begun to understand. Guns are awesome. There's something primal and powerful about being able to defend yourself. I had never shot a gun in my life, and I had devised many scenarios in my head previously. I had so much adrenaline pumping through my veins that my hands were shaking at first. Then I calmed down and began practicing my aim on the target that was 25 yards away. "You're doing well," Ralph said with pride. My heart surged. After we had spent about 2 hours at the range, Ralph packed up his guns and walked over to a group of men that were hanging out and chatting. Although he is usually quiet around new people, Ralph was so at ease entering this conversation held among strangers. He and the men began discussing guns immediately. They were very impressed by his M4, which he had assembled himself. They were also kind to me and occasionally made eye contact with me, even though most of the time I had no idea what they were talking about. I felt proud of Ralph's abilities and knowledge, and for the first time, I was able to experience his world with him, and that made me feel closer to him. I walked away from this experience feeling like I had gotten to know Ralph better, even though I had known him so well already. I also felt I was now a part of his world, not simply an observer. Ralph, of course, is so excited that I like to shoot. "We now have matching Facebook profile pictures shooting the M4, said one friend, "You really are perfect together."
You are listening to Off the Page on WRKC Wilkes-Barre, a series featuring students reading the works they've created in and out of class.
Avast ye homeowners! Are ye plagued by foreclosure? Well, here at Jim, Lot, and Matey, we can stop your foreclosure now. We're a mortgage rescue company, and for the small fee of everything you hold dear, we will negotiate with your lender on your behalf, and we guarantee results.
Guarantee results!
Aye, the bird speaks the truth. Them's be the benefits of working with a true professional. So don't dilly-dally about. Listen to the wise counsel of your old pal, Honest Jim.
He can't be trusted!
Call Jim, Lad, and Matey at 1-800-YAR-YAR. That's 1-800-YAR-YAR-YAR.
If you're facing foreclosure, make sure you're talking to the right people. Speak with HUD-approved housing counselors free of charge at 888-995-HOPE. That's 888-995-HOPE. Brought to you by NeighborWorks America and the Ad Council.
How do you wake up the entire African-American community to the hidden issue of mental health problems?
It showed up in my life through one of my best friends, and we've been friends for over 30 years.
Share your story.
If we would have known earlier, you know, we would have been much more supportive with her.
Once I reached out to my sister, it got a little better. Once I told my mother, it got a little better. The more I talked about it, I felt it coming off.
The healing is in me, and the healing in a journey can also be extended to others.
It's our community and our mental health.
Giving voice to what you're feeling is part of the healing.
If you're strong enough to just open your mouth, that's all it takes.
And the most revolutionary and healing thing that Black people can do right now is to love one another.
It's time to share ourselves. Healing starts with us. Search online for stories that heal. A message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, the Ad Council, and the Stay Strong Foundation.
We now return to Off the Page on WRKC Wilkes-Barre, Radio King's College.
I'm Jennifer Yankoski. I'm a full-time instructor of English at King's College. I teach a lot of freshman composition and a lot of our creative writing classes here. I teach Introduction to Creative Writing, a short story workshop, and a lot of independent studies in creative writing. What's exciting for me is just their dedication to it. You get these students that sort of surprise and amaze you with what they come up with, the imagery they're working with, and then their honesty on the page. At first in the semester, you have to kind of talk them into being honest and, you know, no one's going to see this if you don't want them to. And then slowly they start to open up and they're putting these just really important and touching stories on paper. I mean, immediately they realize how that can sort of release them from maybe feelings they've been holding on to for a long time, and that just that therapeutic quality of writing, that not only does it help them, but it speaks to other people and can help other people. I started writing when I was in high school, but I wasn't going to be a writer at all. And then I ended up coming to King's as a history major and immediately switching to creative writing. And that was it. I was just... It grabbed me. And poetry, which just has always been my favorite genre, and creative nonfiction. So that's what I mostly work in.
My name is Robert DeLulo from Williamsport, Pennsylvania. Writing really came about from my interest in books originally. And I just find writing to be a way to really get to know yourself. And it's really just an adventure in your mind, really. And I'm into, adventuring and things like that. So writing for me is the most personal adventure that you can have. Probably about ninth grade, I got into serious, or I considered it to be serious writing with like poetry and things like that. But lately I've moved into more short story writing and nonfiction. I feel like that's more challenging as a writer for me. This piece, it is for Dr. O'Connor's literary journalism class that I took a year ago. And it is a memoir piece about the summers that I would work with my uncles doing construction work. And the piece I'm reading is The Summers of Solitude. The room is black, except for the early morning light coming in through the curtained window. The blinds are still drawn, but the light is creeping in already. My feet throb. I've tied my work boots too tight, but if I don't, my arches will ache the rest of the day. I sit in the overstuffed couch in the living room, hoping to conserve my energy, because I'll be working for the next 10 hours. I trace the flower designs on the couch's armrest, as I've done every morning this summer. Like clockwork, the garage door next door opens, breaking the silence I was drifting into. The scene plays out in my head, since I have seen it so many times before. My uncle lumbers out of his garage holding his blue and yellow lunch pail and coffee mug, and balancing an unruly assortment of papers and blueprints. I sigh and use a few ounces of my energy to heave my body into a standing position. I put on a paint-splattered forest green Ham Improvements hat and walk next door. It is 6:45 a.m., and the morning dew makes my shoes, and subsequently, my socks wet. Just get through the next 2 hours, and you're home free. I work for my two uncles, Steve and Ern, who run a general contracting business. We paint, my favorite, drywall, build additions, lay concrete, repair roofing, my least favorite, and any other construction idea that a customer wants, other than plumbing. We don't work with crap, as my Uncle Steve says. I've learned to rewire an electrical cord, spackle, repair holes in walls, build joists, lay brick, and countless other tasks. I know where all the screws in the trucks are, all the penny nails, roofing nails, shovels, drills and their batteries, nuts, bolts, washers, rakes, and every other implement of destruction that is used during the day. I've trained my memory and instincts to know where a tool is located before one of my uncles even asked me to get it. Most importantly, for me, I've trained my mind to think that 9 a.m., my day is over. At 9 a.m., it is only 1 hour till 10 a.m. Hopefully, there will be a break there. At 10 a.m., it is only 2 hours to lunch, hopefully. And once you get to lunch, which in my opinion is the halfway point of the day is already over. In my mind, if something doesn't get done before 9 a.m., no point at even trying. By afternoon, there is certainly no point at even trying to start serious work. I'm not getting much done after a belly full of grapes, pretzels, and a cheese sandwich that I cursed and reluctantly ate, for the cheese is melted by the summer heat. I try to tell myself this timeline, because as much as I wish it were true, it is not. We work and work hard. For hours we labor in the heat of the summer. A ring of sweat dirties my hat, usually by 10 a.m. or 11. Luckily, I don't have to use my mind to plan this work. I just work. And when 5 p.m. comes, we're done. At least that's what I pray verse upon verse for during the day, which always cracks me up because by this time I've lost my interest in Christianity. But a lot of the time the day stretches to 5:30, as my uncles, who finished working at 5, are standing around talking about not a relevant fact in life for the next half hour. Great, I have football workouts, I remember as I climb into the passenger seat of my Uncle Steve's work van. Week after week, Monday through Friday, I go to work out with my high school's football team. Although lately I've been skipping Fridays to go smoke and play basketball, like any other kid in America wants to do on a Friday night when you're 16. But it's not Friday. Not sure what day it is, actually, since my watch doesn't tell the correct date or time anymore. But it's not Friday, I know as much. I shake my head as I doubt that mentally surviving the day ahead is possible. Uncle Steve starts his van. It sputters and rolls out of the driveway. The radio is turned to Kiss FM, as it is every morning. And every morning, it annoys me as we ride to work and those horror days that come along every so often when Kiss FM, with the most unfunny DJ, doing painfully unfunny routines, is the radio station at work. But on the other hand, if I am lucky, the ride will last up to 20 or 25 minutes, and I'll be able to return to that zone in between sleep and waking. This morning is not one of those mornings. We arrive at the work site and begin to gather the tools needed for the day. Today we are doing a pour, as we refer to it. Some tools will be essential. Others, to me especially, will seem in the way. When I trip over them and land in the wet concrete, hoping at first that no one saw, but more importantly that the moisture doesn't soak through my pants and getting me wet. We are building a concrete slab, which would seem like a rather simple task, but actually is the most strenuous and taxing and tiring job that we can do. Before I know it, the cement truck has arrived. I grab a garden rake and take my position for battle. The cement flows fast, and I have to move quickly and gracefully in oversized yellow rain boots. The boots protect us from getting stuck in the solidifying concrete and keep our skin from being irritated. I get irritated regardless, since my job is to use the prong of the rake to pick up the iron fencings that help the concrete set and maintain form. It's simply pain, and I always get stuck doing the job. But I don't say anything, because they're my uncles, and they treat me well and pay me all right. Besides, even though I'm exhausted by the work after 15 minutes, there are several important benefits to my job. First and foremost, I listen to music all day, which helps the day pass. Uncle Ern usually plays the Grateful Dead, or the Allman Brothers, or the band, which are some of my favorites and the best to listen to while mindlessly working outside. Second, I work outside. Third, the work I do is manual labor, and there's something in my DNA that views manual labor as beautiful. There's a respect a person gets from working with one's hands, getting calluses, and a stiff pain that will grow over the years. Yet the most important benefit is that since the work I do requires very little thinking on my part, my mind can wander. Thoughts, usually of the future, start slow. The months living in Cape Town were thought of years before on some heat-exhausted highway of my mind, but the past rears its head from time to time as well. Maybe I would notice the clear blue sky, or a line in the song would catch my attention. Then that thought leads to others. From blue sky, I would subconsciously connect the world within War and Peace, the scene where Prince Bukowski is lying injured on a battlefield, realizing that the picturesque sky is the only thing in the world that matters. That philosophical thought would then lead to others. I would pass by what death was and what life was. From there, I would try to imagine the life that I would want to leave. Do I want to be a writer like Tolstoy, or just embody his morals, or give away everything like he did at the end of his life? Maybe I can be a house painter with a wife who is an artist. Maybe I could be a musician. I always wanted to be in a touring jam band, because that effort, put in day after day, is unlike any other. Jam bands are the hardest workers in the music world. The Allman Brothers were a good band, listening to them during the summers especially. Hey, their song Blue Sky is on. And then I'm back to reality, until the next time my circular thoughts began to wander. My mind's solitude has shielded me from noticing that we started painting the fence around the slab. It was after lunch now. My thoughts had worked perfectly, and only a couple of hours until we're done. When I paint slowly, dipping the brush into my can, evening the paint on both sides of the bristles. I shovel the paint onto the fence, and then distribute it from there, making sure to check for unsightly runs. People, mainly my father, call me a sloppy painter, but they just don't know how to paint, or at least I tell them. One has to get it in all the cracks and the crevices and holes and divots and ditches, and have the layer be thick. I want painting to take as long as possible, although it will never last as long as I hope. Painting only happens every once in a while, so we have to cherish it when it does, just like having a trip into solitude. This is my day for 5 summers in a row, before ninth grade, to the summer before I came to college. Those days are gone now, but sometimes they come back like an apparition. They shaped me unlike any other. Those summers created my foundation and put on a nice finishing touch. I see the world from those days in solitude and with the beauty of labor.
My name is Tamara Sager, and I am a professional writing English literature major with a Mass Comm minor. Well, I've been writing poetry since I was in third grade, and it started off kind of, I would listen to the songs and think that, oh, I could be in like this singing group, and we called it the Sparkling Angels, and it was really just a bunch of us getting together writing poetry and attempting to choreograph them to like music. When I'm writing, I'm taken away to a different place, a place that's just mine, and I can escape like the realities of the world. This first poem is called Blue Eyes, and it was published in this issue of the Shope. We lived a dream, a series of metaphors, convoluted waters made clear. Deep was our connection, the coalescing of souls, drawing us closer, closer with each walk, each encounter. My heart never escaped me so easily, nor has it ever been so easily horribly bruised. Cryptic, beautiful, blue-eyed monster, how, why do I hate you yet love you? Everything was perfect. We could have been perfect. But your lies, your games, your I can't drag you into a life I've yet to figure out, just to run into the arms of another lover after all the I love yous hinted at, whispered, implied. Try as I might to forget you, I can't. You haunt my thoughts, my dreams, your blue eyes constantly reminding me of an almost lover, now refusing me even a whisper of a look. I cry for an unrequited love until common sense kicks in. Then I realize, I don't miss us, I miss you, and that, my dear friend, makes all the difference. This poem is called This Is Not a Poem About Love. This is not a poem about love. This is not a simple girl reaching towards the stars, looking back on her past with regret. This is not a blue-eyed wonder gazing into some ethereal depth, searching for something cherished, something lost. This is not two star-crossed lovers quarrel, and this is not some fundamental profession of adoration. This goes much deeper than that. This is the sword repeatedly piercing my soul from the lies your warm eyes encouraged and your mouth spoke, causing volcanoes to erupt within my weakened breast. This is the whispering glances you gave as our hands joined to become one, as you hinted towards a future, towards some heavenly covalent bond causing our two spirits to align. Just when I thought everything was getting ordinary again, it was not. Even in my dreams, you haunt me, torture me. It was you who changed everything. Fortune had me give you a chance when I should have otherwise ignored the snake in the garden. Reality was suspended for that one experience, giving me something I will heretofore regret. If only now the world could make sense, vindication does not seem to exist within the realm of false pretenses. Your kisses, your smile, your lies linger behind a veil, obscuring what I want and hope to feel as reality. Until I let that pain go, that us will forever be my hell. This is not a poem about love, but of pain.
You are listening to Off the Page on WRKC Wilkes-Barre, a series featuring students reading the works they've created in and out of class.
From the vantage point, Mafatu saw six war canoes drawn up on the beach, but what held the boy's eyes in awful trance were the figures, the eaters of men, cannibals. Mafatu watched the strange scene, powerless to move. In that very instant, he heard a crashing in the undergrowth. Four figures were tearing through the jungle. He turned and ran blindly down the trail, thinking only of his canoe. If only he could reach it before the savages overtook him. Explore new worlds. Find out what happens next by reading the book Call It Courage by Armstrong Sperry. For other great book ideas, visit literacy.gov. A message from the Library of Congress and the Ad Council.
In 1966 in Anchorage, Alaska, a talented child was born. He would go on to be one out of only 11 Alaskans to make it to the major leagues. The odds of him striking out more than 3,000 hitters? 1 in 33 million. The odds of this pitcher being selected to the Major League Baseball All-Star Game six times? 1 in 48 million. The odds of this fast-balling philanthropist winning the World Series three times? 1 in 3 million. The odds of this man having a child diagnosed with autism? 1 in 110. Hi, I'm Kurt Schilling. Learn the signs of autism at autismspeaks.org. Autism is getting closer to home. From 1 in 5,000 only 20 years ago, today 1 in 110 children are diagnosed. Early diagnosis can make a lifetime of difference. Autism Speaks. It's time to listen. Brought to you by Autism Speaks and the Ad Council. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission.
We now return to Off the Page on WRKC Wilkes-Barre, Radio King's College.
My name is Jason Clark. I like the idea of telling a story with writing. Probably because I've been reading my entire life, and sometimes you have fun telling a story, and sometimes a story just needs to be told, whether it's fun or not. This was an assignment in my creative writing class. We had to take four very different articles that we'd read, and we needed to write the paper as though we were telling someone who wasn't in our class what we'd been doing. And I chose to tell this as an interesting narrative, directed towards a student who showed up for the first day of classes only, as if I were trying to keep him informed so when he came back, he could catch up. And this is entitled, Your Call Has Been Forwarded to an Automatic Voice Messaging System. Scrolling through the phone list on my cell, I spot Jason LaNunziata and hit send. He wasn't in class again today. Four rings and he's still not answering. I guess I'll have to leave a message. Your call has been forwarded to an automatic voice messaging system. Jason is not available, At the tone, please record your message. When you are finished recording, you may hang up or press 1 for more options. To leave a callback number, press 5. In the 30 seconds it will record, how am I supposed to tell him about everything he missed in class today? After 3 seconds of silence, I hear a beep in my ear. I'm still not sure what to tell him. He only missed one day. The work we are doing is so much more than simply reading the text and discussing what happens. The readings are so much more complex than the simple plot summaries that we give in class. It's even more complex than examining multiple stories and how they connect or overlap in theme, time period, or style. We are examining each text for multiple meanings, and even that doesn't really explain what we're doing. Each text we read has multiple meanings depending on who is reading it and how they approach the topic. How do I explain to Jason that it's like Luke Skywalker entering the cave at Dagobah to face the dark side of the Force? The expectations, limitations, and fear the reader brings into the cave determine how much they can learn from the text. The message I leave for Jason is a simple one. I ask him to call me back so I can tell him there's more to the story than just kids and baseball cards. Jason's first comment about the story at the beginning of the semester was, "Dude, it's just about baseball cards. How hard can it be to read that?" But he obviously didn't get to page 3 of Mary Louise Pratt's Art of the Contact Zone. I couldn't wait to tell Jason about that page. After writing about her son and his baseball cards, she kicks it up a notch. In that capacity, my contribution is undoubtedly supposed to be abstract, irrelevant, and anchored far outside the real world. I wouldn't dream of disappointing anyone. I propose immediately to head back several centuries to a text that has few points in common with baseball cards. When I read that, I knew we were in for trouble. This text is much deeper than a story about kids and is baseball cards. That's also when we hit the first major shift. Suddenly we are talking about the process of finding an obscure text in a library. What does it mean if an author's work is never read? If it's read by someone other than the intended recipient? What if the correct recipient does not know how to make sense of what was written? A deeper question I have is, if this wasn't read, or was read but not understood by the recipient, is there any point to reading it today? The people and topics discussed aren't relevant in this modern society. Shouldn't we just throw this 390-year-old letter in the shredder? These were just some of the questions bouncing around my brain as I waited for Jason to return my call. Perhaps he finished reading the story by now, and we could hash out what we were supposed to do about the assignment for this reading. There was more in the Pratt story than the question of readership. There was a very unique style of writing in the story within a story. The text Pratt discusses was from a Peruvian named Felipe Guam Poma de Ayala and his attempt to communicate with King Philip III of Spain. Poma learned enough Spanish, combined with his native Quechuan and his drawings, to attempt to present his message in a manner he thought the king would be able to understand. Poma didn't stop there. He did more than just write a message to the king. He tried to educate the king on multiple levels using multiple teaching styles. His use of allegories, drawings, and symbolism within each style and at every level of communication in the letter were an incredibly complex method of giving his message the best chance for comprehension by the reader. The drawings repeated the message of the text in visual form. The symbols of the two cultures were as intertwined as the meaning of the words he used to craft the ideas he was presenting to King Philip. Creating a message is important. Getting the message to the recipient might be even more important. If the message is not received, it doesn't matter if it's well-crafted. Why isn't Jason answering his phone today? Maybe he... Well, oh, whatever. Maybe he really did come down with swine flu. He could be at the doctor's office right now. How do I tell him about our discussion in class today? Whatever I say in this message will never convince him there's a connection between Pratt and the story by Edward Said. Is he even listening to my messages? If he's not, what I say won't really matter. When Jason and I discussed this the other night, this text seemed like a rather dull bit of writing that merely explained the photos in the book. But the discussion we had in class, more than 30 minutes on the first paragraph, and much of that time was spent on the words in the first sentence. Caught in a meager, anonymous space, outside a drab Arab city, outside a refugee camp, outside the crushing time of one disaster after another, a wedding party stands, surprised, sad, slightly uncomfortable. Just the discussion about the word outside was, beep, these voicemail systems drive me nuts. Sometimes they let your drunk friends ramble for hours. But when you have something important to say, it takes 3 or 4 calls to leave a decent message. I need to tell Jason about what makes the Saeed text fit with Pratt's work. I think it's possible to see a new layer of meaning in Saeed's states. Getting that through in 30-second soundbites to Jason, that's a whole different ballgame. Seeing past the photo summaries takes work, but we can start to see how the people presented are outside the mainstream of society. They are the small minority voice that Poma was writing about in his text, The First New Chronicle in Good Government. They are the voice that Pratt calls members of a safe house. These small groups of downtrodden and dispossessed people are searching for a way to reach out, make contact with others in Pratt's contact zone. The reasons these groups have for reaching out and trying to communicate their ideas may be different or have a different goal. Their purpose can be summed up by Pratt's term, autoethnographic text. She defines this term as a text in which people undertake to describe themselves in ways that engage with representations others have made of them. They are describing themselves so that they can be seen more clearly by the larger society. Saeed States seems to engage the readers in this last sentence, if not before, in this autoethnographic way when he writes, two strikingly marked openings in the building, openings that suggest rich, cool interiors which outsiders cannot penetrate. Let us enter. The doorways he describes in the picture are symbolic openings he is creating in his community and culture. They allow us to enter his contact zone and explore his community. We would dishonor his memory, his community, and his safe house if we refuse to even darken the doorstep of the portals he's presented to the world and states. When Jason and I are playing pool, shooting hoops, or just hanging out, Jason always seems to drop the ball and grab his phone on the first ring. Why does it seem like most of my calls to him end up in 30-second voicemail bites? If Jason really has the swine flu, he must be really sick because he's not answering my calls from yesterday or today. I'm not sure I understand the connection to this new text and the previous two we've examined in class. Maybe it's just as well I have to leave a short message because I'm not sure how to describe what Harriet Jacobs has to do with the previous readings. Well, at least not something I can say in a voicemail bite. Jacobs writes an interesting story, but if it's supposed to be her life, why is she writing as Linda Brent? She says she's trying to protect others by not using real names and places. Doesn't her owner and her family realize she's already run away? We're supposed to suspend our disbelief and assume this story is a true autobiography of the former slave when she writes, I do earnestly desire to arouse the women of the North. This feels very different from what I would expect a former slave to say about her target audience. Yet the entire text has that same undertone that is slightly off-center of what we would think of as a slave narrative. That's what I found so perplexing about this text. The style of writing used by Jacobs seems too smooth and too elegant compared to what I expect from a slave narrative. The dialect and vernacular used seems consistent with other works I've read from the 1850 to 1880 time period. Certain parts of the text feel too edited and smooth to be her work, unless L. Maria Child, the editor, cleaned things up more than she admits in the introduction. Even with this admission from the editor, there is something about the style that seems odd. She switches from narrative to directly addressing the reader as easily as she switches paragraphs. In other places, Jacob seems overly dramatic. Dr. O'Connor said in class that this was typical of the melodramatic romance novels of this period. This may be true, except that I would guess a typical melodramatic work would be written entirely in that style, not a paragraph here and there as Jacobs has done. If I had never read Pratt's Art of the Contact Zone, I wouldn't have the term autoethnographic and the example of this type of writing from Poma's letter to use as a tool when examining Jacob's incidents in the life of a slave girl. It's almost as though Jacobs knew what Poma had done with his letter and was mimicking his style of mixtures. Poma used Spanish, Quechua, and drawings in an attempt to make sure his message could be understood by a lowest common denominator. Jacobs was using a combination of autobiographical story, direct address to the reader, and melodramatic styles to make her message comfortable for the delicate and refined ladies of the North to whom she was writing. We will never know if this was crafty editing, inspired writing, or a lucky accident of Jacob's education. Regardless of how it happened, this quirk in incidents in the life of a slave girl gives this text a complexity a casual reader might miss, and that some would discredit as poorly written for its inability to stick to an acceptable single style of writing. This time the call is answered on the second ring. I don't get the mechanical woman telling me your call has been forwarded. Instead, I hear Jason's tired voice as he answers the phone. Jay, I tell him, you have no idea how complicated these stories are. I'm glad you're feeling better, but you're going to drown in the depths of these amazing works and will still never hit bottom. His only reply is a soft groan.
Hi, my name is Kevin Conroy, and today I'll be reading an excerpt from a piece I wrote for Mrs. Jennifer Yankowski's creative writing class. My story is named Echoes. Dan slipped past a crowd of his fellow students, brushing past a blonde girl speaking briskly about the injustices committed by her parents, and up to his locker. He turned the lock to the correct series of numbers, pushing in and up forcefully. The large dent that some bygone incident had left surrounding the latch made opening the locker somewhat tricky, and the rusty door and hinges did not help. He had grown used to it, however, figuring out the right pressure and angle to get it open smoothly. Dan tossed his mass of papers and a few textbooks into the top compartment and grabbed his backpack. He glanced around the door and down the hallway, spying Kat amidst a flock of her friends. She was beautiful, with long dark hair and piercing green eyes. She was speaking to the crowd at large, clearly the center of everyone's attention. He wasn't sure if she even remembered his name. Dan turned his attention back to the locker, glancing at the picture of himself with his friends Sam and Ron, trying to steady his heartbeat. Sam, ever studious and brilliant, frowned with her arms crossed as he and Ron attempted to scale an old grate on the side of an abandoned building. Ron was almost at the top, while he was stuck halfway up with his foot caught in the bright green, prolific ivy that clung to the broken-down old house. He mused over the incident, wondering why he had not felt nearly as nervous hovering 15 feet off the ground with his foot in an ivy death trap as he did now. He shook his head, clearing his mind, and closed his locker. Briskly, he patted down his unruly hair, gathered the small remnant of courage he had managed to hold on to, and walked towards Kat. She glanced up from her friends and watched him as he approached. "Hey, Kat, I don't know if you remember me, but we had gym together last semester." He swallowed with some difficulty, and, he stammered, "So, how'd it go?" "Don't ask," Dan said, looking extremely dejected. He was in no mood to talk to Ron right now. "Wow, that racy, huh? Can't even talk about it in public," he said, laughing. He pushed his glasses further up his nose automatically. "Oh, come on, you'll live. Did she pull some old rusty bloodstained knife out of her bra and try to castrate you with it?" "What? Oh, no, that's terrible, man," said Dan, shaking his head and trying not to laugh at Ron's sick imagination. "See, it can always get worse, much worse, my friend." They passed through Clearbrook High's big steel front doors and out into freedom. A throng of people pressed around them, none of them willing to linger within the musty confines of the school any longer than was required by law. A few of the passers-by looked at Ron like he had just been dredged up from some hideous nether region of the local lake. He didn't seem to notice. "So, we still on for tomorrow night?" Ron asked. "Tell me we're still on for tomorrow night." "Yeah, man, don't worry about it. We're still on." "Sweet, I was beginning to get worried." They walked on, past columns of worn yellow buses, students climbing in the front while clouds of acrid exhaust billowed from the back. Dan listened to the crunch of gravel under his feet as they passed through the dusty parking lot, noticing it disappear as they stepped up onto the concrete sidewalk that shadowed the road arcing away from the school. On the other side of the walkway, there was a steep, grassy slope that bordered the vibrant green football and soccer fields below. They watched a parade of buses pass by, now full of noisy students. After the buses had all sped by, Ron, attempting to be discreet, crouched low and started to climb down the hill. The grass was slick, however, and he lost his footing and tumbled down the hill amidst a cloud of obscenities. Dan covered his face, laughing. "You all right there, bud?" Dan asked. "Shut up. I'm fine," he said. Ron regained his footing and struggled up the hill a little ways, sat down, pressed his back against the grass, and lit a cigarette. Dan slid down next to him a little more gracefully. "Dude, you realize that, even though no one can see us here, there's still a highly visible cloud of smoke hovering suspiciously over this section of the sidewalk, right?" "Eh, whatever. You talked to Sam lately?" "Yeah, I'm going over to her house tonight so she can help me with some bio work. Can I get a drag of that?" "Wow, you really are depressed. Remember, after you get hooked and you're alone, dying in some miserable little cot with tubes sticking out of you like a damn jellyfish, that it was your decision. I had nothing to do with it." He handed Dan the cigarette. Dan clumsily took a drag, breathed out the smoke, and coughed slightly, silver-blue trails billowing out of his nose and curling around his hair, then leaving to rub their backs against the sky. "Hey, hold it right there, you little bastards. It was McNulty, the overweight groundskeeper. He was careening towards them across the field below in his little security cart, his bulbous red face more puffed out than usual. They ran, tumbling down the hill, Ron falling, but quickly scrambling to his feet, Dan cursing his luck. Out over the soccer field they ran, past the nets and the carefully painted lines, McNulty gaining on them. Sweat dripped down his face despite the fact that he was not the one running for his life. The trees that bordered the campus were getting closer. So was McNulty. Their legs burned, pummeling their feet into the calm field. Cut grass flew through the air behind them and sweat stung their eyes. They breathed fire into their lungs and exhaled smoke. As the tree line approached, their spirits lifted and hope surged strongly through their veins. They jumped, crossing the drainage ditch that circled the field. Ron tripped, falling to the freshly manicured lawn on the other side. McNulty did not stop. His beady eyes grinned with the sweet satisfaction of revenge. McNulty was almost upon him when he slammed into the ditch, his chest hitting the black plastic steering wheel, catapulting his face into the black steel safety bar in the front of his cart. Dan sighed in relief. Ron got up, and together they dashed into the thick undergrowth of the forest. They were soon concealed amidst the trees. "Oh, by the way, here," Dan said, handing the still-burning cigarette back to Ron. "You're good, man."
My name is Maggie Height. I'm a senior at King's, and my major is English education. The first work that I'm going to read today is The Lady in the Hallway. I don't remember her that well. I remember she liked to sew. I remember plaid material with reds, greens, and blues constructed throughout, like a kilt of some sort. Was it Christmas time? No, it was summer. I remember she was kind. I remember she was old. I remember she took care of my sister and I. I don't remember her name or even her address. I remember she lived in an alley. Our dad would bring her to our house to visit. He liked her, I think. She stayed with us, but I don't remember how long or even why she stayed. She had her own home, though, I remember. I remember the big argument between Mom, Dad, and the lady. I don't remember the what for. They said she had to go. With me at her side, I remember she stood in the hallway listening to them argue. I don't remember how she said goodbye exactly, but I remember she said goodbye in the upstairs hallway, and she was gone. I don't remember if I ever saw her again, but even after all these years, which are many, I know she existed. I know she meant something to me. Why or how, I don't know, but she did.
Thank you for listening to Off the Page on WRKC Wilkes-Barre, Radio King's College. We'll be back soon with another show of students featuring stories and poems they've written for class and for the show, the King's College Literary Magazine.
Some statistics are surprising, some are unbelievable, and some are simply unacceptable. Right now, nearly 30% of U.S. students aren't finishing high school. Nearly 30%. And that's the average. In many places, it's even higher than that. And fixing it is a responsibility that we all share. This is President Obama, and I urge everyone, not just parents, but friends and neighbors and family members, to take responsibility for encouraging the high school students in your communities, to support them, challenge them, push them a little, and do whatever it takes to help them make it through. Because this is one statistic we simply can't afford to ignore.
You can do your part by going to boostup.org and sending an email, a text message, or even a wake-up call to a student at risk of dropping out. Go to boostup.org and provide the boost that's needed to make it to graduation. A message from the U.S. Army and the Ad Council.
We are talking about our world today. Oh, and someone's on the line.
Hi. I'm Jacqueline.
Welcome, Jacqueline. How old are you? You sound so young.
I'm 8.
Oh, wow. I assume you're a student, right?
Yes, from Jefferson Elementary. And I have a question.
Sure. And what's your question?
We all know the Earth has 7 continents that currently carry 193 countries. Those continents make up 29% of the Earth's surface, meaning that the vast majority of our planet, 71%, is comprised of water. Taking into consideration man automatically adapts to environmental conditions, why is it that I need to take swimming lessons?
Are you ready for kids who eat healthy? Good nutrition can lead to great things. To find out how a healthy lifestyle can help your child succeed, go to mypyramid.gov. A public service announcement brought to you by the Ad Council and USDA.
This is Kyle V and Adam James of Gypsy Blood.
And we're coming to you from across the tracks on Radio King's College 88.5.
We be under attack. Man the long knives!
Prepare to be boarded.
Flagship, starboard bow!
What? No, not by the enemy flagship. By garbage. Me beautiful ocean be full of it these days. It flows in from rivers and drain pipes. Many of folk don't know that when they throw trash on the ground, it eventually makes its way into the ocean. How can I enjoy Sail Me Bonnie Seas with all this trash in it? Why, there's soda pop bottles, plastic bags, even stinky leftover takeout. Fire at will, men! Lend us a hand by always recycling and disposing of your trash properly. If you don't, I'll make you walk me plank. Nah, just kidding. Seriously though, learn more what you can do to keep the oceans healthy at keepoceansclean.org. Brought to you by the Keep Oceans Clean Alliance and the Ad Council.